we've paid an awful price in the West for believing this person is the wise person. Wisdom resides in a community, and you see it in an individual woman or an individual man, but it belongs to the community.
Welcome to the Sacred Land Film Project's audio archive, where we revisit the interviews we left on the cutting room floor after 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. This episode is the second of two parts featuring my interviews with the prolific writer, Barry Lopez. If you haven't heard part one yet, I recommend that you go back and start there, as it leads to this hour's conversation about the wisdom and power of community. Barry Lopez's written works explore the relationship between nature and human culture, and include Arctic Dreams, for which he received the National Book Award, of Wolves and Men, and his most recent masterwork, Horizon. I've described Barry Lopez as a master storyteller and a wizard with words, though, to me, he was also a close friend and ally. Sadly, Barry passed away in December 2020, following a long battle with prostate cancer. I was lucky to meet Barry back in 1980 when I was an intern at Mother Jones Magazine. We were organizing a conference on technology, and I was tasked with calling up all the speakers, Barry among them, and coordinating their travel. At the time, I had no idea that our meeting would be the start of a lifelong friendship. In 2011, I interviewed Barry for a four-part film series called Standing on Sacred Ground. As the interview started, our decades-long conversation came full circle, as Barry opened the interview in the very place where our friendship began, at the nexus of technology and human nature.
There are many versions of the story about how we got technology. A story that we bring down with us in Euro-American culture is Greek, about Prometheus. And to give the story short shrift, Prometheus steals fire from Zeus, and that signals a moment of independence for people, separating themselves from the powers that control them and determining their own destiny. And in a version of the story that's hardly ever told, and you'll see why in a minute, Zeus says to Prometheus, "Good for you. Now you've got a tool that could serve you well, and you think it will. But I'm here to tell you that if you don't have something else, which I will give you, this will come to nothing, less than nothing. It will become a nightmare for you to just have fire. What I'm giving you now is reverence and justice. And with these two things, it could work for you. But without reverence and without justice, this tool-making ability will be your end." So the first time I came across that story, I thought, this is like a key and a lock that we need to know about. What is the trouble if you sit down with somebody in Dushanbe in Tajikistan, or you sit down with somebody in Cape Town in South Africa, or you sit down with somebody in Kyoto and say, "What's going on?" I think you can make some headway in agreeing that a technologically sophisticated world like the one that we've built has become more expensive than we can afford because it's not informed by justice or by reverence. So it's possible, I think, in a time like ours, which almost like iron filings to a magnet, people are coming together and saying to each other, "What's going on? What can we do to ensure that there will be something for our children and our grandchildren to work with, just to work with, to survive? How can we ensure that? Everybody's asking that question now.
Although Barry was a writer and I was a filmmaker, we were both drawn to these core questions of humanity. The beauty, but also the shadow side, the lack of reverence and justice that characterizes so much of modern society. An avid traveler and observer, Barry opened himself up to so many different worlds and ways of being, resilient cultures that orient their way of life around reciprocity and connection with the natural world. I asked Barry to talk about these values and the importance of reinfusing our world with reverence and humility.
Well, reverence is capacity to feel certain emotions, to have certain feelings. Awe is a feeling that you're capable of because you have a capacity for reverence. And reverence essentially is a capacity to see that there is something beyond human knowledge and human control, and to conduct yourself accordingly. The striving, I think, that is prompted by reverence is to be in good relations with everything around you. That means deference and courtesy and an awareness of how the great mystery makes itself manifest in every aspect of the living world, and probably in aspects of the world that we don't in the West consider to be fully alive. That is, their temporal and spatial coordinates are such that we can't see them as living things, you know. In my experience, I would say that traditional people all over the world have in common a set of perceptions that are not as self-confident about the meaning and direction of life as ours are. The hallmark of a first world invasion of a traditional society is, one way or another, it's one person saying, "We know and you don't." And the people who are on the receiving end of that saying back, although they're never heard, saying, "We've been on that road. Be careful. You can open any newspaper in any town in America every day and read that story. We thought it was going to work, but it didn't, and many people died." So I think what traditional people are trying to say, whatever the context is in which you find them, meaning the position from which they're speaking, is to urge us to not be so confident about our ability to control the world the way we think we can. And when you're talking to Pintanjandara people or Aranda people or Pintupi people, they are saying to you, "Look, we've been doing this for 45,000 years or 50,000 years. We tried that. We don't think it's going to work. And we've been looking at it every 100 years or every 1,000 years or so, and don't be misled by the lack of outward complexity here. We're living the kind of life that sustains us and brings us to heightened levels of joy and appreciation for each other and social stability. We've all the big things, we've taken care of that. And you're proposing a world that we long ago found out was not going to work very well for human beings, and that is to try to control everything." I think traditional people put a strong emphasis on humility, and that is not a virtue that many of us in the West support enthusiastically. We tend to see humility as quaint, or an aspect of a life that's not forceful enough, instead of seeing it as moderation. And again, traditional people often talk about humility as a strategy for survival. So traditional people are asking us to be cautious, and I think the complaint of a lot of people in our culture is that the people in power in our cultures have no sense of humility, have no sense of caution, and because they don't, they create terrible problems for everybody, for everybody.
So what happens when a culture turns away from humility and embodies this paradigm of control? And how does the current moment of ecological crisis and social unrest stem from a mindset of extraction?
We have this term, the West, by which we mean North America, Europe, and places like Australia, for example, the nations that are technologically sophisticated democracies and announce themselves as the forefront of human thought and progress and pointing the direction down the highway of life that every one of us is supposed to follow wherever we're from. If you come from those countries, you have a difficult time understanding what somebody like me would say, that as the result of my travel, I would say that the world is on fire. By that I mean that the disturbance of viral ecologies, the actual burning of vast forests, the collapse of pelagic fisheries in all the world's oceans, the discovery of these vast seas of plastic within the oceans. Everywhere I go and I see these issues, I'm stunned when I come back to my home in the United States and find out that these worldwide disasters are either unknown or have been promoted by mainstream media in the United States as folklore, groundless speculation. If I say that the level of denial in my own country about the difficult straits we're in, Homo sapiens is in, the human organism is in dire straits, if I say that, I include myself in the problem, and I don't have time to be pointing fingers. And sometimes I know I sound like that, but what I want is compassion for everybody. We have created a disastrous system. It's killing everybody who comes in contact with it, and we must stop it. And the only way to stop it is to recognize, every one of us recognize our complicity in this system and have compassion for people who are so caught up in it, they have to deny it or they can't look at themselves in the mirror in the morning. This comes almost at the level of heartbreak, and that is to be in a traditional culture that has minimal security in terms of food resources, money, access to media, things like that. When you walk into a place like that and somebody who appears to have nothing shows compassion for you who appear to have everything but are living in denial of the pain you're causing everybody, that's a moment in which I don't know how you keep from emotionally breaking down. They're forgiving you for killing them. All they're asking is, would you cooperate with us while there's still a chance here and make something that will allow your children and my children a shot at survival? It's so difficult to break through the American consciousness of can do, are capable, we're right, and reach people at the level in which they will understand it's not about you running the world. It's about providing with the strengths that you have to create and maintain a world in which other people can survive, in which other imaginations can come to life. We're not doing that. The argument over global climate change is like, for me, listening to 2 5-year-olds arguing over who was responsible for losing the shovel for the little bucket in the sandbox. What is threatening us here is enormous and utterly, utterly indifferent to our fate. We're living in a time in which a relatively small group of people do not have the courage to stand up in front of their boards of directors and in front of their shareholders and say, "This is killing us and people all over the earth. We have to find a way to cooperate. If government won't do it and business refuses to do it because they're held prisoner, they're held hostage by their own ideas of the need to create material wealth for people, we're doomed." Unless people make this very important decision, which is to say, "I understand government will do nothing. I understand that business has no interest in addressing this problem. So then we have to do it." We have to be able to say to each other, "The women and men we have elected to office are behaving in a cowardly way, and they're being manipulated by those who believe that if you can keep a strong political structure, then you can solve all of these problems. You can't solve these problems that way. The political structure we provided for ourselves is useless in this situation, and it proves itself to be useless every day."
Many of us, myself included, were raised to look up to politicians as voices for what is right. We're told from a young age to trust in the political system, in American democracy. But for so many, this system has never served them. And at a time when the call for new leadership and different forms of governance is growing louder, many are asking, who do we turn to? And how can we step into the power of the collective?
If you go among cultures around the world and ask not for the elected leaders, the self-appointed, the wealthy, the power brokers, but ask a culture for its elders, when things are really bad, who do you go to for advice? And often that's not anybody in government, even in our country. You go to what used to be called the elders. Why? Because they are people who have had the gift of paying attention all of their lives. And quickly, when they were young, they weren't people that needed to be supervised. They quickly got to a place where they were paying attention. They didn't require somebody to tell them do and don't, because they were listeners when the other elders spoke when they were young, and they've become repositories for what we know. They weren't seduced by this thing that we have in the West, "I know, I say," that the poison of the individual genius, that very dangerous person, whoever it is, you know. We've paid, I think, an awful price in the West for believing this person is the wise person. Wisdom resides in a community, and you see it in an individual woman or an individual man, but it belongs to the community, and it comes to life in a person, and the person passes, and the wisdom continues, and the people that keep it going, carriers, runners, different words in English for it. Those people are taking care of something that they never think they own. They have responsibility to take care of it and pass it on. So if you could go to all of the cultures that want to be part of the discussion and ask that their elders gather and answer this question, how do we reinfuse our way in the world with justice and reverence and courage? I think nobody knows what the elders are going to say. Not even the elders. Many elders, despite the outward appearance of spiritual centeredness, calmness, compassion, humor, are hanging on by their fingernails. I think one of the most dangerous things you could try to do today would be to pay attention at the level that would allow you to take in how big the water is, how perilous a situation we're in. But, you know, we safeguard ourselves by not taking in too much. And the elders are out there at the far edge, they're taking in way more than most of us can manage. So when they speak, not only should we listen, but we should recognize the risk that the elders are taking in speaking. Life is not something with an answer. You know, life is the big question. What does it mean to be alive, and what does it mean to be fully alive? I think that so much of what traditional people have to say, people have been saying for 15,000 years. What is a good way to live? Take care of each other. The older people watch out for the younger people. And the middle-aged people take good care of the children. So there's a chance for everybody to survive in the world. Not to make progress. I really don't know what that means. How can you, if you're in love with God, what would progress be?
As Barry shares here, to drop into the depth of the crisis we're up against can be paralyzing. But this important conversation with Barry reminded me that change and the movement for justice is a collective task, one that taps a deep well of intergenerational wisdom that is held by the community rather than any one person. And from that starting point, we might ask, what would best support the regeneration of group wisdom as a resource? If not conventional government, what process will help us create a world of justice and reverence?
The failure to imagine a way to organize a society except under a government of some sort has made it difficult for us to understand how traditional peoples have functioned for so many tens of thousands of years without a government. I asked a traditional man one time, why is it that these first world nations, whatever, I don't know the proper term, I've never been able to come up with a term to describe the nations that have supreme economic power and military power in the world. But I said to this traditional man, why is it that they're comfortable asking you to come to the table if the topic is environment or if the topic is spirituality, but they don't want you at the table if the topic is government? Why aren't you invited to come in to talk about government? You're treated like wise men when it comes to spirituality and maintaining a healthy environment, but they don't want to hear from you when the top subject is government. And he said, oh, well, that's very easy to explain. They know that we can't imagine government without a spiritual foundation and environmental awareness, so we're not going to be any use to them when they want to talk about government, because their idea of government is it doesn't have any spirituality and it is not environmentally aware. I think this idea that the problems we have, like global climate change or ocean acidification or residual aquatic Prozac, whatever it is that you say, oh my God, this problem, how will we ever do anything about this? They aren't problems that have an answer. You can't develop a policy that's going to take care of the criminal tendencies of turbocharged capitalism. The policy's not going to do it. It has to happen here. It's got to be courageous people who simply stand up and say, I will not permit you to do this to my children. And the fact that you have the support of my government is immaterial to my presence before you right now. I am telling you, put those things down, stop doing this, you're harming too many people. And government won't do it. I mean, wherever you go in the world, you see that this is a dangerous thing probably to say, but democracy is an experiment. And we see a lot of good in it. And in places that are overpowered, countries that are driven by tyrants of one sort or another, democracy feels like a good idea, and it is. But look at our country. This is a democracy, and some would have it the model of democracy. But democracy is not a very effective form of government in an emergency. And that's where we are now. So we have to invent something that replaces democracy. You see what I mean? It just, the statement itself is so outlandish in a way, or I don't know, it suggests anarchy, I guess, but I'm not talking about anarchy, I'm talking about imagination. And that's why when you say, what would the elders say? That's where we're going to find the elders. Ask them a question that terrifies you, and they'll talk to each other, and they'll find something, and they'll be able to speak it. And then the rest of us will think, oh, that's interesting. How can we make that happen? And that's why I say from time to time, the most productive conversation that we can have in the world at the moment is the people in every single culture, to bring their best people forward and let them have a conversation. They're going to talk to each other in ways that are difficult for most of us to understand. And with our democratic frame of mind, we're thinking they shouldn't be talking unless I have a voice. But you know what? Time is short. And about all we have, I think, at the moment, is the hope that there will be some way to push the tyrants to the periphery, including systems of economic exploitation and their acolytes, push them all to the periphery, and have those people who still can maintain a sense of hope about their own culture and human cultures talk to each other about what would international cooperation look like. Not international government, not international business, but international humanity. What would that look like? And to have the humility to say to that group of elders from all of these different cultures, okay, instead of trying to tell them where they're wrong or that it's not going to work or you're not going to participate, we can't minister to the tragedy that human life has created on the planet by having everybody go in a different direction. And the obvious choice after watching human social organization for tens of thousands of years is to say, this situation where the elders speak and the rest of us listen, that's what's going to work.
I asked Barry if, after so many years of travel and listening, he could speak about a central message he's heard from traditional elders and how this has shaped his thinking.
So if I were in a position where I felt I had the authority to say something definitive about this. This is coming from a man who doesn't believe anybody can make a definitive statement or write a definitive book. I would say that a reasonably smart person would look at how many different intact, more or less, traditional cultures all over the world maintain this one idea at the center of their identity. Maintain a conversation with some place on the earth that empowers you and in which you feel that you are in the presence of the sacred, that all else that is part of material culture or the mundane, the ordinary, disappears. You feel it so strongly that you make every kind of behavioral prohibition against profanity of any sort near this place. No profane thought, no profane language, no profane behavior. You might even ritually wash and dress again to enter into the state. When you see that all over the world in cultures that are so battered they can barely breathe, the only conclusion I think you can come to is maybe this is important. And not because we've made the investment in progress believe that it's part of the past, it's something that can be dispensed with, it's something that's primitive. It's not primitive, it's profound, and it is not part of the past, it's part of the future. And when I say it's part of the future, I mean if we cannot rediscover a conversation that is culturally distinct to us, a conversation with the earth, I think we're doomed. We have to find some way to begin again a conversation we cut off because, like adolescent children, we thought we knew better than our parents. And that's the situation we're in. I know better than the earth. And every traditional culture that meets us says, you need a little bit more maturity before you speak with such authority about what it is that you can do here. You don't know.
This task of beginning again and stepping back into a conversation with the earth calls us to break from old patterns and think differently, perhaps in ways that we might not yet know. Barry once said to me, all of this has to be dreamed again. And so I wondered what he might say about his own work and the role of storytellers in helping us imagine a pathway forward.
Well, you know, I'm a writer, and that means that when I travel, I'm often interested in a conversation in which I can learn in another culture, what does that mean to be a storyteller in your culture? What kind of person is that? What do they do for the community? Because my world as a writer is so compromised by issues of popularity, celebrityhood, and income and bestseller lists. That confuses the idea of the relationship, the ethical relationship of the storyteller to that storyteller's culture. So I was having a conversation with a traditional man one time, and we were talking about the distinction that we make in the West between fiction and nonfiction. And I asked him if that made sense to him. And he said no, he understood how I was using the terms and that they were useful to a certain extent. But he said, you know, for us, the difference is not between fiction and nonfiction. It's between an authentic and an inauthentic story. And I said, well, what is that difference? And he said, an authentic story is about us. And an inauthentic story is about you. And in that moment, I saw something crucial for me, and that is that the story that you tell as a storyteller is not worth our listening to if it's just about you. We don't need to know about you. We need to know about us. So if you're going to tell a story and you want it to be an authentic story, it seems to me it's got to do two things. First of all, it's got to help. The story has to help. And the second thing is, it's got to be about us. The listener or the reader does not want to be in the position of being lectured to or being treated as somebody who's not capable of knowing or treated like an outsider. And that's a very valuable lesson for me as a writer. If I go someplace, I'm trying to listen to people different from me saying something with great history behind it about what it means to be a human being. And then I want to come home and compose a story and offer it to my own people and say, this is what they said. What do you think? I want everything that I write to end with that note. Here's what I saw. What do you think? Instead of saying, here's what I saw and here's what you should believe. That can be part of it for me as a storyteller. I want more than anything to see people do well. I want to see people thrive. And the system I see in place all over the world is a system that is killing people. And I feel that as a physical pain. I feel a sense of grief every day when I get out of bed. And despite my own failings as a writer, as a human being, the driving thing behind me is, if you're going to tell a story that helps. And if you're going to become involved with other people, filmmakers or artists or whomever I'm going to become involved with, make common cause with people whose desire is to help. Not to direct the show or tell somebody else what to think, but to behave in a helpful manner. for the benefit of everybody, every being.
Listening back to these interviews now, I am still in awe of Barry. The way he moved through the world with such openness and heartfelt integrity. I wanted to know more about how Barry grappled with these feelings of grief, living so fiercely and nurturing hope in the face of despair.
I have often asked myself how I could take in as much disaster as I have seen traveling around the world for 40-some years and still remain hopeful. At a sort of practical level, is it possible to do this in order to affect a better state of circumstances? I would say I'm not optimistic. But I would say that I am hopeful, and the reason I'm hopeful is because wherever I have been in the world, I've found women and men with a sense of poise or what I might call a sense of grace in the world, who are capable of behaving in imaginative and graceful ways in the middle of disaster. So I would say I was someone who not only had witnessed horror, but who had witnessed the antidote. And the antidote is the creative use of the imagination to piece together a world for humanity that no one has articulated. I think that the burning villages behind us, if you will, the things that have been left in smoking ruins, the price of using the world as a dumping ground and a warehouse, the price of using people as slaves at one time or another, you don't forget that. But we're not in that place all the time. There's always the possibility to do it a different way. And my hope is fed by the number of people I have met who simply won't go down. They are entirely bankable. A natural death will take them from us. But until that day, I think those people will be standing strong for other people. And when you encounter them, you see other people who, if they're at a tipping point, lean into their ability to act and to affect change because of the presence of that one person who is galvanizing other people's efforts. So a good thing to do in terms of a practice in the world is to locate in individual cultures the stable, strong, long-term, dependable people and ask them what can be done in this situation and wait for them to say it with their own timing and in their own language and then try to meet those requests, knowing that you have to be willing to give those things and say, whatever you do with them, that's your business. I'm not here to tell you the only ways in which you can use my generous gift. You have to be willing to step back out and say, that person will take the car that I gave them, the little office that you gave them, the computer, whatever small thing that most of these situations that we face don't need enormous amounts of money in order to stabilize communities around disintegrating social structures and natural disasters and things like that. They just need a few things and the belief of people outside their community that they can manage their own stuff. And they'll do it. I think at that point you can feel you've made a genuine contribution. You don't wait around for a thank you. You don't look around for somebody to give you credit. You just give what you have, say thank you, and leave. And the situation will straighten itself out. It is so naive to believe that one culture knows and the other culture is waiting for your knowledge. They're waiting for your help at certain points. But we don't live in a world in which one culture can teach another culture what it means to be a human being, a full-blown human being. Everybody's been wrong here. And also, everybody's got a little piece of what's going to go right. And that's what we need to knit together. Not pointing fingers at the people who are wrong, but identifying the people we believe are right. And letting those people we believe are right talk to each other and tell everybody else to just please shut up for a while. It is such a waste of our precious energy in short supply to identify and castigate enemies. All of that energy could go into the discovery of a kind of beauty or the rediscovery of a kind of beauty. And by beauty, I mean beauty is the state of good relations. The more perfect the relations, the more beautiful the thing is. And that's what we're trying to make. We're trying to make ourselves beautiful. We're trying to make the society of which we are a part, each one of us, our family, our relationship with a spouse. We're trying to make it beautiful. And the more we do that, the better off we're all going to be.
In filmmaking, I'm often trying to create something that is artistically and visually beautiful on screen. But the quality of beauty that Barry spoke about in this interview, beauty as the state of good relations, shifted something deep inside of me. I believe that our capacity to love and create beauty, when we are in the fullest expression of our humanity, are the gifts that we bring to this earth. And Barry helped me see that. Several years after speaking with him for our film series, I called Barry to interview him for Earth Island Journal in 2019. Though we'd set out to talk about his new book, Horizon, Barry also reflected on the greater arc of his life, speaking candidly about his challenge to navigate grief, his worries about the future, and the sources from which he drew the strength to keep going. This was my last recorded interview with Barry before he passed away in December of 2020.
You know that moment that I describe in the train crossing from Sydney to Perth and big thunderstorm and the windshield wipers can't keep up with the rain and then it all suddenly clears and there are rainbows and these kangaroos racing across the Nullarbor Plain and these two guys I didn't know from Adam, you know, I'm just in the locomotive with them. We all felt it, that whatever the thing is that we want to be a part of, here it is. And then we all shook hands. I don't think anybody could explain why we shook hands. I think among men who were strangers to each other, it was a safer thing than hugging. But it was essentially the acknowledgement among a group of strangers that they were just absolutely thrilled to be alive and that whatever they did in their lives, they wanted to make this happen for other people. You're thinking right away, oh, I've got to tell my wife and my kids when I get home about this wonderful moment. So you draw, when grief makes a claim on your time, you draw the strength to resist from the quality of your love for everything around you. I think people in battered societies, part of the trick of survival is knowing that you can express your love and that you can receive someone else's love. You can have that reciprocation. And when you begin to draw on it, you find that it leaves grief less room to enter your body, to enter your mind, and make you feel despair and the emotions that create a sense of wanting to give up. I think one of the great lessons of love that has emerged since the 60s for all of us is that if we can't take care of each other, there's really nothing to take care of. I mean, yes, we want to control the amount of CO2 in the air. Yes, we want to dismantle dams. Yes, we want to get the plastic out of the ocean. Yes, we want recycling. But there's no point in doing that unless we take care of each other at the same time. That's that find a way to love each other and care for each other so that when any one of us goes down, we will either have the strength to get back up or others who are our friends will lift us back up and shake it off. It's all intertwined in the sense that no one person is responsible for figuring anything out. We're trying to do this. Where, you know, the example I always give is cranes migrating, where they line out maybe as far as a mile and a half, more or less wingtip to wingtip. And they look up and down that line until they see somebody who's caught a thermal. And then they all go over to that place and rise up, you know, another 1,000 or 2,000 feet. And then they break out into that line again. And it's just luck that one or another bird finds the thermal, because they're on a glide, you know, they don't have the energy to flap their wings for dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of miles every day. They've got to depend on each other, and nobody cares who found the thermal. And maybe Eddie over there is going to get lucky and find five of them in a day, and they'll all hoot about it later when they land. But that's the model for us, you know.
Since this interview, I've held on to Barry's message that we have a responsibility to take care of one another. Barry lived this prayer. He always showed up for me and to support our wider community of friends and artists. And when I listen back to these interviews, I feel his unyielding spirit encouraging us all to create more beauty in the world, or as Barry described it, coming into relationship with the places we call home and with one another. Like those migrating cranes, we are stronger when we move together beside those we love. To listen to more from my interviews with Barry Lopez, tune into part one at sacredland.org, where you can find our full audio archive as well as films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. To browse an extended list of Barry's work or read messages from his friends and family in memoriam, you can visit his website at barrylopez.com. This episode was produced and written by Hannah Wilton and Toby McLeod, edited by Callie Shanafelt Wong, and recorded by Isaac Butler Brown at Dirt Studios. Our film interview with Barry was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger, along with co-producers Jessica Abbey and Jennifer Huang. This episode is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in Lejeune, Ohlone Territory, in Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.